Welcome to RCGP Scotland Presents Generally Speaking. In this, the 10th episode of the podcast, RCGP Scotland Chair Dr. Chris Provan is joined by Dr. Stuart Mercer, Professor of Primary Care and Multimorbidity at the University of Edinburgh, to discuss academic general practice and healthcare reform.
So, today I have with me Stuart Mercer, academic general practice. Looking forward to having a good conversation, really about your role. Stuart, do you want to tell us a bit about yourself? Will that be okay?
Well, thanks. Thanks, Chris, for inviting me. So, I'm a Professor of Primary Care and Multimorbidity at the University of Edinburgh. I was a GP for 25 years or so until last year, when I decided to hang up my boots, but I'm still full-time at the university.
And so you're an academic general practice, and the college is really keen to support academic general practice. It's part of our role there. What is your day-to-day job like then? What do you spend the day job doing?
Yeah, whenever I worked in general practice, and I was going off to my university job, the staff would say, is that you on holiday now? So I think there's not a great understanding of what we do. So a typical day, as a sort of senior academic, we have quite a large team of middle grade and junior grade researchers who do all the groundwork, really. So a lot of it is actually management of staff and keeping things on track, making sure you're hitting deadlines, because the funding's always short term for a year or two, so you have to finish everything on time. So so a lot of it is just keeping your eye on the ball in terms of the specific projects that you're doing. Typically, we get funded for individual evaluations or research on a particular topic. And then there's teaching. So I do some teaching with medical students and master's students and so on. And then there's the inevitable university committees and meetings, future of things in the university. So it's pretty varied. I think that's what's good about it. At the end of the day, I mean, my job as primarily a researcher, so my job really is to provide evidence that's useful for general practice and primary care.
So how do you decide which studies you're going to do?
Well, I think it's a combination of what lights your fire, you know, so what you're passionate about. And I've always tended to follow that as my kind of instinct. And what funding is available. So there's usually a bit of a trade-off. You have to go where the money is. But I've always managed to do that in a way that, you know, keeps my own particular interests alive. And actually, John Howie, he was a former head of department in Edinburgh. I mean, that was very much his strategy, and he was one of my mentors. So I think I learned that trick from him, is that sometimes you have to, you know, weave a bit. But it's really important to keep sight of what general practice needs. And I think that is general practice research on generalism, health inequalities, and so on and so forth. The core stuff that we do, rather than only being interested in a particular single disease.
Often it's looking at generalism, and you've done research on the 2018 contract and things like that. But what do you think is the outlook for GP academic opportunities?
Well, we have got a new sort of cadre of young GP academics in Scotland who are great. And in that sense, I'm quite hopeful about the future. They're very good. They're very enthusiastic. But we don't have great support, I have to say, compared with, say, the career pathway for academic GPs in England,
right,
where they have a much more sort of complete career pathway, even up to the level of professor. So there's professorships in general practice through NIHR in England, for example. So we are always, we can't really compete with England. We have fewer opportunities. Bottlenecks that happen. So you think, okay, I'm a GP, or I'm a GP in training, I'd like to do an academic. So what do you do? So there's a small number of what's called SCREDS lecturers, lectureships. Therefore, doctors in training. So you extend your training, your clinical training, and do part-time research, typically 50% or 20%. And we've been quite successful in getting some GPs in those, but there's very few of those. They're not ring-fenced. And then once you qualify as a GP, you can apply for NES clinical academic fellowships. But the number of hours available was cut last year, so there's fewer than there was, and that's going in the completely wrong direction, I suggest. And then if you're serious about being an academic, your next stage would be to get a PhD. And that's the first big bottleneck, because PhD funding's difficult. GPs are in open competition with every other specialty, chief scientist office or MRC or Wellcome or whatever. And then after that, once you finish your PhD, there's a second bottleneck, which is postdoctoral fellowships, whether that's from, again, MRC, Wellcome, and so on. So at each stage, you tend to lose people.
Yeah.
Who drop out. So it's a tough gig, really. You've got to really want to do it. And it might be, could be, and should be better supported, because I think every discipline, every specialty needs an academic base. And if we don't have that, we're not producing the sort of evidence that we need.
Yeah,
for our discipline.
I mean, we've certainly benefited from going through and having discussions with evidence from the Scottish School of Primary Care and reflecting on that. And I think we've also been trying to discuss with people the benefits and stop the reduction in academic fellowships, because you do want that career path to be clear. I've met actually at the Primary Care Researchers Conference a couple of the young GPs wanting to be academic, and they were fantastic. And and it also fits often with the kind of portfolio careers and other things like that. So we need to encourage that, especially when more care is going to be taken care of in the community. We have to think about how we do that. So I think that's something we would agree on, how we actually support that. You were at recently a conference with really looking at different new models of care and reflecting on the research around that, especially in Scotland, England, and Denmark, I understand. Unfortunately, I wasn't there, but I'd be keen actually for you to really give us some headlines and on what came out of those discussions.
Yeah, so this was a kind of high-level workshop, if you like. It was invitation only. We wanted all the key organizations that are involved in primary care in Scotland. And we had, so it wasn't a big conference, it was a kind of small, let's get together kind of talk.
Right.
But we had invited speakers. And so we invited, it was about 50 people invited, about 35 were able to make it, different organizations. We had two representatives from the primary care division of the Scottish Government who came as observers. They didn't take part in the discussions, but they were keen to be there. It was, I think, quite a useful meeting. And then we had sort of keynote talks, if you like, from Professor Checkland, Kath Checkland from Manchester University, who talked about what's happening in general practice and primary care in England. We had myself and my colleague Eddie Dunnicky talking about our evaluation of the new GP contract in Scotland, which we've done over the last 4 years or so. And we also had Mogens Vestergaard from Denmark, who talked about the very interesting developments in general practice in Denmark, the recent developments. So, you know, we had a nice spread of different views. And then we got into small groups and discussed, you know, what needs to happen in Scotland next for primary care transformation. And just briefly, out of those discussion groups, we came up with a number of themes that people had talked about. And I'll just give you the headlines. So there were four key themes that came out of discussions. One is the need for a clear vision from the Scottish Government for general practice. Second was the issue of continuity of care and relationship-based care. Third was the perceived need for transparency and accountability. And I would say that was at all levels. I mean, one of our speakers was from Audit Scotland and talked about their report. And in their report, you know, take issue with what they see as a lack of clear vision from the Scottish Government on this. But there was also felt to be a need for more transparency in terms of GPs as independent contractors, and indeed in terms of the multidisciplinary team expansion, which in terms of, well, is it effective? Is it cost effective? You know, there's lots of questions around that. And the final theme, and not surprisingly, was about long-term strategy and sustainability of general practice and primary care. So, you know, these, I think, now this meeting was before the recent announcement of additional funding for general practice from the government a few weeks ago. So clearly some of these themes, you know, would relate to that. I think just to mention very briefly the issue in Denmark, I mean, it is pretty amazing for us, I think, for me. Denmark has managed to get cross-party agreement to increase direct GP resources from 8% of the budget, of the health service budget, to 13%.
Yep.
Over a certain number of years. And from that, to increase the number of GPs from 3,600 to 5,000 within the next 10 years. Interestingly, they've also gone for proportional universalism with a plan to reduce list sizes in the more deprived areas where patients have got more complex needs, more multi-morbidity, for the same level of income. So, you know, deep end practices in Denmark, which they have, will potentially be, you know, might have a list size of a GP, maybe 500 or 600 patients. But of course, the need is much higher, so they'll be spending longer with those patients. The thing that's kind of interesting is that Denmark hasn't gone for a big expansion of the multidisciplinary team. That's not really part of their agenda. They've gone for expansion of the general practitioners.
Yeah.
So, and this is, you know, it's been agreed by the parties. There's draft legislation. It's out for public consultation. But my understanding is that the mood music is pretty positive. So this will be a pretty big achievement.
We've spoken to Denmark representatives as well, and it's interesting to learn from what they're doing in other countries. So talking about Scotland and Denmark, how does the actual number of GPs and where the GPs are target the needs of the population?
I think the first point to make really clear, and in the report that we will be publishing on the inverse care law, and indeed there was an evaluation done last year funded by the Health Foundation on the inverse care law in Scotland. The first recommendation of that is that GP funding as a percentage of the NHS needs to be increased across the board.
Yeah.
For the whole of general practice. It's not a question of taking from Peter to pay Paul. It's we need more GP funding. And that's what Denmark's done.
Yeah.
So then nobody's losing out. But once that's done and GP numbers are increased and so on, then the case for proportional universalism, giving matching need with workforce, is what's been proposed in those reports. And again, that is exactly the position of Denmark. So there's no agreement from the government in Denmark that, you know, no practice will lose money, but in the more deprived areas or areas with complex patients, then, you know, there'll be more money per patient to meet those complex needs. So it's not a question of saying we should redistribute funding to general practice, taken from some practices, putting them in others. That wouldn't work. It wouldn't be a good idea. It's to redistribute once there's a bigger pot of money. And of course, the recent announcements from the government and the BMA 2 weeks ago were very welcome, because it does seem like quite a substantial increase in core funding. And some mention of health inequalities in that, although the devil's always in the detail, and I don't know yet how that's going to pan out. So that was also very welcome, as mention of missing this.
Yes.
And having some resource to do work on that. So, you know, I think the future looks pretty bright compared with maybe how it was
good
6 months
good.
Ago or a year ago.
Good, because I agree that, I think there's agreement across the system that we need to think about where we target our resources, where it is greatest need, and research shows, as you know, around the need in health inequalities and the number of problems that patients in those areas come along with and just the complexity of it. I was interested, you touched on the multidisciplinary team there. What is the evidence around that in our Scottish contract and just in general terms, and touching on England as well?
So we did, as part of our evaluation, so we had a grant from the ESRC, so an independent grant from the UKRI, to look at the GP contract. And it was a grant of about £1 million, so we could do quite a lot with that. And the first thing we did was we did an international systematic review of primary care transformation. What are other countries doing, high-income countries? And we've actually found that expansion of the multidisciplinary team is one of the most common things to do, partly because there tends to be a shortage of GPs in most countries.
Yeah.
So it's not an unusual thing to do. I mean, I think it's the first thing to say. Our evaluation looked at all aspects of the GP contract, particularly clusters and MDT expansion. And, you know, at the end of the 4 years, I would say it's not all been bad and it's not all gone swimmingly well. And it's a case of, is the glass half full or half empty? But I think most people would agree it hasn't gone according to plan. Now, part of that is because the pandemic came along, clearly, and that was very disruptive. But I think there are questions around the difficulty integrating the MDT teams into practices. They're not employed by the GPs, by and large, they're employed by the HSCPs or the health boards. They have different line managers. The GPs tend to have not a lot of say in what they actually do in the practice. The staff often come from secondary care, and they often find it very difficult to cope with the pace of primary care and the patient complexity. So, you know, it has not been disastrous, but it has not been a full-blown success. And, you know, I do think there would need to be changes to make the actual integration better. If it's to continue long term.
But looking at the research you did, it didn't, unfortunately, because it reduced GP workload, because the idea was to free those up for the complex care as well, but it hasn't really done that. Patients often, for those types of things, want to see a GP.
Mm.
What about the RRS
in England?
So, in England,
so
additional roles scheme.
Yeah, that's right. So England went down a slightly different route. And Kath Chetland talked about this in her talk, and she's one of the leading, if not the leading, primary care policy researchers in England. She's been doing this for a long time. She told us that, again, there was no evidence for a reduction in GP workload in England with the ALRs. Right. There's a huge number of different roles, more than 40 different types of new staff.
Right.
So it's much broader than up here. And she didn't even know what some of these people were meant to do. And they don't call it a multidisciplinary team, because, in her words, there's no resemblance to a team. These are individual staff brought in to do that one thing. So I think, again, there's big issues around integration within practices, duplication, fragmentation, and so on and so forth.
Interesting you use the word fragmentation, because that's a word I hear and I use a lot around this. And that's the flip side of continuity of care in some ways. And as you know, there's lots of evidence. We've done a previous episode with Miles around continuity. So it's trying to get that balance right there. Just looking at our own manifesto, it has a few of the themes that we've picked out here about increasing the percentage of funding going into general practice. But we're calling for 11% moving to 15% in the long term.
Just say, Chris, so the meeting we had, it was two meetings in the same day.
Yep.
And in the morning, it was about primary care transformation and what's happening across the board. And that was really mainly to, so we could sort of disseminate the work we had done on the new contract. The afternoon meeting, and that's what the report is on, which is available on the Scottish School of Primary Care website. The afternoon session was specifically on the inverse care law and health inequalities.
Yeah.
And that was led by Carrie Lunan and David Blaine. And that report is almost ready to be published, and that will also go onto the Scottish School of Primary Care website. And I think this issue of the inverse care law persisting after all these years, and we know it's still a big thing.
Yes, we've known about it for a long time. We actually tackling it is the difficult part.
Yeah, so I think that is what Denmark's doing, I think, is a real example of what could be done.
Yeah, I mean, in Scotland, we've got the service renewal framework. That's a pretty high level, talking about more care coming into the community, and we broadly welcome that as long as it's resourced well and we need to think about how that's actually implemented and learn from what's happened before. I'm just going to go off on a slight tangent, really, to ask about walk-in centres.
Okay.
And the announcement about those walk-in centres, just do you have any sort of, with your contacts, headline news on the evidence around walk-in centres when they've been tried elsewhere?
Yeah, so they were tried in England 20 years ago, was it? Something like that. And they were well evaluated, largely by Professor Chris Salisbury at Bristol University, but also by others. And the evidence in favour really very limited. I mean, what really happened was the people who took up the services, well, what we might call the worried well, it was younger patients with minor illnesses, often self-limiting illness. The more affluent patients, and not the kind of multimorbid complex patients where the NHS should be at its best. It wasn't cost effective, and they were eventually scrapped. So when this was announced in Scotland, I think many of us were quite surprised, given that there's really no evidence that I know of that would support them. So, you know, time will tell how they go.
I'm going to say, first of all, thank you very much, and thank you for your role as chair of the college. I've always been well supported by asking you about research questions, and I appreciate that. I'm going to give you a final chance to sell an academic career to younger GPs. Is there anything else you want to add for that?
For me, it's the best of both worlds, because the clinical work is exciting and it's reasonably immediate. I mean, you do a good consultation, it feels good. You think, okay, job well done. The academic work is a slow burn. You might wait 2 or 3 years to get the answers to your question, and you might find out it hasn't worked in the way you intended. But that's research, and then you publish it. It's in the international literature. It's there forever for people to see.
Yep.
So
yep.
I do think a clinical academic career is really rewarding. It's like a portfolio career. There's lots of different aspects to it, and I would thoroughly recommend it to any young people.
Good for you, and I think we need to support at different levels that academic general practice. Thank you, Stuart. That was great.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Generally Speaking, the RCGP Scotland podcast. Be sure to follow us on social media to stay up to date with all of the work and news from across the college.